the team, in fact, at the Center for Interdisciplinary Health Disparities Research. It is one of the NIH's ROMAP centers for population health and health disparities, funded by both the Cancer Institute and the Environmental Health Sciences Branch. I'd like to put the epidemiological methods and research involved in this kind of in these kind of studies on a much firmer social sciences basis, theoretical basis. In essence, if we're going to talk about population epidemiology, I think we have to talk about social epidemiology and the social structures that drive these disparities in health. Population level. It goes beyond counting numbers, but looking at the processes that generate these data, generate these numbers, and structure their form. In our center, we are literally going from gene expression data on individuals up through the individual psychosocial environment, the household, the immediate micro environment of the neighborhood, out to the communities that these neighborhoods are nested in. So we're really concerned with the geospatial mapping of these social phenomena and the spatial structure of these neighborhoods. When we look at this research, of course, there's a long, rich history, as was mentioned, in terms of the Chicago School. And in observing and measuring what it is about neighborhoods that gets under the skin, there's this concept of social disorder. What is this indicator, this signal that we're looking at that emerges in neighborhoods? And we're looking at higher order social structure. These are emergent properties, if you would, of neighborhoods, of communities. And I'm going to go quickly through this, but point out this whole question of what are the broken windows a signal of? What are they indicating? What is social disorder in a neighborhood? Is it neighborhoods, you know, bad neighborhoods, good neighborhoods? Is it neighborhoods behaving badly, as it were, or their residents behaving badly? Or is it a question of social policy, neighborhoods being treated badly? And where the rubber meets the road in many cases has to do with the policing of poor neighborhoods. When broken windows and signs of social disorder are taken to be signals of criminal intent rather than of policy redlining, as you would, or disinvestment. And in the context of Chicago, let me just say that Chicago is the Chicago metropolitan area stretches across three states, Milwaukee down to Gary, Indiana. It is hyper-segregated, if you would. It is an extreme example, but the processes, as you can see from the other speakers, extend across the metropolitan areas in the U.S. And in fact, this actually has global implications with urbanization processes happening across the globe and this type of urban poverty that develops within social structures, the social hierarchy. I would argue this is a form of a structural violence. What you see in Chicago over a 30-year period was neighborhoods that had high concentrations of public housing were overwhelmingly black neighborhoods, initially, and then as Latino population grew, they started including Latino populations as well. But what you saw at the beginning of the 70s, the employment rate within these public housing units, within these neighborhoods, were about 90%, which is still almost depression level unemployment or employment levels for the white communities in the U.S. But by the 1980s, that fell to 25%. And then by the 90 census, it was 4%. This is not an individual phenomenon. This is a community phenomenon. And, you know, obviously what that implies in terms of once you have unemployment rates fall to that level, what it does to housing, what it does to transportation systems, toxic exposures, and all kinds of mail distributions across multiple domains. And then when you get down into this level of multiple domains, you're talking about weak ties, if we can borrow from our social scientist colleagues, as opposed to strong ties. The strong ties are the family ties, the kinship networks, the intimate friendships, which people rely on in their daily lives. But it's the weak ties in terms of making livelihoods in neighborhoods, finding employment, the daily activities of life when you go down to the stores, the grocers. And this is where the labor market is affected by the stripping off of the weak ties, essentially. This is where the social capital aspects come into play in terms of caring about your neighborhood, social control, social disorder. And in terms of employment effects, employment is directly related, of course, to incarceration. So what are people going to do if they don't have employment, and how do they make a living? This is from a Robert Wood Johnson fellow's Recker and Raphael, Recker Johnson and Raphael. And these two curves, this is an HIV, which is a very fast response social phenomenon, if you would, outcome measure. This is the difference for black women. HIV infection rates between white and black women. What happens is if you take out the effect of male incarceration, African male incarceration, you see, in fact, that the difference is negative. Again, this is another what if. If the incarceration rates were held steady instead of being policy-driven in a linear increase fashion over the decade of the 80s and 90s, this is what would have happened to the infection rate. Taking it back to Chicago, this is how the neighborhoods are distributed. Again, low, medium, high SES quartiles, and the percentage, the racial composition of the neighborhoods. When they say over 75% or greater African Americans, typically these mean they're in the 90% percentages. And what you can see is the distribution is such that there are no lowest quartile and lowest tertile SES poor neighborhoods, no highest quartile Latino neighborhoods. There are a lot of black neighborhoods, so you see some scatter upwards here, but overwhelmingly low SES. And what that looks like geographically is these are the black neighborhoods, deepest blue, over 90%, over 95%. The white neighborhoods, these shaded areas in between, these tend to be the Latino neighborhoods, the mixed neighborhoods. And what that translates to this one outcome that my center studies, breast cancer, is, again, this is from the City Department of Public Health, did this little map. They are focused on mortality and not incidence, but it's a double-coded map with the red being the highest, the red tones, red, orange tones being the highest mortality, and the darker shades being the highest incidence. And what you can see is a difference between the postmenopausal and the premenopausal young women, corresponding to these black neighborhood areas, extremely high, such that the mortality rate is literally double overall. So behind the linkages between the physical and social environments, in this concept of social disorder, what we did was try to build up these indicators of the physical environment in terms of the weak ties, the walking distances around the woman, and look at this sort of ecology of city neighborhoods, and tie in this concept of social isolation and loneliness with this sort of desertification process of the ghetto core. And this is, of course, related to this whole concept of residential tenure and mobility, where you see, where you watch who moves and who's left behind in these neighborhoods. And these are these macro processes in terms of neighborhood environments, how it plays out, these emergent properties, and how that impacts on individual psychosocial stress levels. You've seen this before in the Unnatural Causes video, how psychosocial stress eventually works its way under the skin. One of the measures we do have that's of great importance I'm going to point out is cortisol levels. And what I'm going to show you is what we'd like to do eventually. There are problems in the administrative units, getting the data, crossing political boundaries, crossing city boundaries, state boundaries. We essentially only have the variables together for the latent variable portion of it in the structural equation modeling portion. We don't yet have together the hierarchical measures. It's on our wish list. This is a sort of analytical framework where you have neighborhoods and these different factors within the woman. These are the neighborhood level, the physical environment, social environment, subjective environment. These would be at the second level, neighborhood level, which we haven't operationalized, built environment survey. This is what I'd like to point out. We have these major crime buffers that we established around the world using the City of Chicago administrative data. Physical environment, vacant lots, fires, buildings needing repair, social environment. These are crime statistics, aggravated assault, homicides, rapes, robberies. Individual demographics. One of the things about the study that's a limitation of it in some senses is because it was powered for the biomedical hypotheses relating breast cancer tumor biology to age and to this loneliness concept. I don't have the numbers really to do this. I'm pushing the data. And what I'd like to do actually is get geocoded NHANES type data to establish those group level measures. But the limitation here in the age is these women are all under 60, 65. BMI, extraordinarily high BMI rates. These are grade 3 morbid obesity, for those of you who pay attention to that. Waist to hip ratio, these are again beyond the 0.8 that's considered a central adiposity indicator. Borderline hypertension. This is a cortisol pattern. For those of you who are not familiar with cortisol, this is a metabolic, a very central metabolic regulatory hormone. We're essentially looking for a signal of distress over this carrier wave, this regular carrier wave, where you have a rise, the fall, recovery overnight. And essentially what we're looking at is this recovery. This rise is stereotypical, part of this central metabolism, regulation of metabolism. It's this area under the curve that we're really interested in. Individual. So we have these three different scales. As it turns out, we can't really separate loneliness from stress, unlike our experimental animal models. Big model, simple model. This is what we could actually operationalize. These are preliminary, it's a draft. And what you see is the neighborhood factors are one big cluster. These are high correlation. You can extract this factor. Individual, again, this hangs together very well. The cortisol, again, it's mainly dependent on this recovery phase. Loneliness, and what I'd like to point out, we don't really have the numbers to do this right. Eventually will. But here, even with low numbers, the environment in terms of predicting loneliness, the social environment, predicting loneliness, the social and physical environment in neighborhoods being related to loneliness. We drove this out to the result. I have a slight disagreement with my biostatistician as to the order of these variables. He thinks that that cortisol comes first, and I think the psychological stress comes first. We're going to work it out eventually. Future work to take this down to the outcome level. Hopefully, the next year I'll be able to show you much more. And then just a plea for understanding the theoretical basis of what we do beyond counting the numbers and what the processes that generate these numbers and eventually hopefully leading to policy decisions or changes. That's it. Thank you. Good. That's part of it, yeah. Thank you. you. It's what I try to bring in is a sense of history to these, and that part of the acknowledgement of the social sciences. If economists can use epidemiological health data to make arguments, then I think the epidemiologists ought to be able to use social science theoretical developments to make their arguments better.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you all for coming.